Today on
Doomed!
With all eyes on Facebook, after the bombshell leaked documents from the Facebook whistleblower, and what seems like, honestly, a real rare bipartisan effort here to actually make a big tech company face some sort of consequences for the harm they have caused. What do you think would happen? And of course it is, and that is, our politicians seem to be screwing it all up by going after Section 230. This right here is the real fight against online speech. And joining me on the show, first of all, let me pull us up here so you can see. Here we go. Joining me on the show is activist, musician, and director of Fight for the Future, Evan Greer. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on.
Now, well, first of all, I should say Fight for the Future, for people who don't know, is a great nonprofit organization that advocates for digital rights. And usually, Evan and her organization are on the forefront of real online free speech issues, not, the usual sort of things that folks like Ted Cruz like to pretend are free speech issues. This is the real deal, and we're going to talk about Section 230. I've discussed that a ton on this show, but I think this might actually be the first episode completely dedicated to really getting into what's going on here with it. But before we do that, Evan, can you quickly give us a quick summary for people who don't know? My last two episodes have actually been about the leaked documents and then the Facebook whistleblower testimony at the congressional hearing. But for anyone who missed those two episodes, can you give a quick summary of basically why all eyes are on Facebook right now?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think, one thing that's important to note is that Frances Haugen, who just went and testified in front of Congress, is not the first Facebook whistleblower. There's actually been a number before her. Not all of them got quite as much fanfare or attention, but I think she is sort of bringing receipts, if you will, for stuff that activists and researchers and experts have been saying for years, which is that Facebook's business model, not just Facebook itself or its practices or this specific piece of content or that specific piece of content, but Facebook's entire business model is fundamentally incompatible with basic human rights and democracy. And, Frances Haugen was the whistleblower that released all these documents to the Wall Street Journal that led to several major reports, basically showing that Facebook has been doing some of their own research, trying to kind of measure the impact of their platform, particularly on vulnerable populations like teenage girls and others. And that basically Facebook also knows that the product that it has made is harmful. And again, I think it's really important that we focus in on Facebook's product and practices, because too often we focus on the speech itself, right? This post, should it be up or down? And, why didn't Facebook take down this post? But they did take down that post. That's kind of missing the point. And what I think was super helpful about Frances Haugen's testimony is it brought into focus the way that surveillance-driven algorithmic recommendation is at the root of Facebook's harm. So it's not just a message board where people can say what they want. They are picking and choosing what content people see based on who they are and based effectively on surveillance of our behaviors, likes, and interests. So at a very high level, I think Frances Haugen helped us at least come to some more specific agreement about what the problem is here. And then, as I'm sure we'll talk about in the rest of the episode, the real question is, what do we do about it? And that's where I think, we need a lot more conversation.
Absolutely. And I feel like, everything you said is absolutely on point. I just want to stress, the conversation before, at least in the mainstream, obviously, advocates in the tech world and, the online rights world, and frankly, on the left, really did focus on, what's going on, have been focusing on what's going on Facebook and what Facebook has specifically done, how they've built their platform. But in the mainstream, the focus, like you've said, has mostly been with specific types of content. You know, how do we deal with misinformation, and not just even like misinformation as a whole? How do we deal with this specific piece of misinformation? And then the same could be said for hate speech, and then extremist groups, and on and on and on and on, dealing with the content. And now we are really, for the first time, focusing on this algorithm. And I for the past couple of months, I've brought it up, like, you know, all these free speech advocates, even a quote unquote free speech advocate, to focus on, you know, content being moderated online as some big sort of free speech issue. I always say, you know, if they really wanted to do that, they would focus on the algorithm, because these online algorithms at the, you know, at the forefront are basically the ultimate thing that's standing in the way of anyone's right to free speech, because they are literally putting their thumb on the scale and saying this content should be seen by more people than that content. And I mean, that's the company, the people running the platforms themselves doing this. So I always baffled me that they didn't go after this.
No, that's so crucial. And again, I think part of the problem is, you know, as you said, the, you know, some sections of the left, and particularly the Democratic Party, has only focused on the harmful content that platforms like Facebook and YouTube are amplifying or allowing. And that's really ignoring basically 50% of the harm, which is all the good content, the important content, the content that needs to be seen, that these platforms are algorithmically suppressing. So that's why I like to use the phrase algorithmic manipulation rather than just algorithmic amplification, because when everything in your Facebook newsfeed is either being algorithmically amplified or suppressed, nothing is just there. And again, that's what makes a platform like Facebook so uniquely dangerous. It's not that, you know, politicians lying and disinformation is not a new problem. You know, go look at crime reporting on cable TV in the 90s. What's new about Facebook is their ability, through surveillance, to kind of micro-target specific types of misinformation directly into the minds of the people who are most susceptible to it. And, you know, we can get into this more in a minute, but I would argue that the best way to kind of interrupt that feedback loop or that rabbit hole effect that has been often talked about is not to try to regulate speech itself, which always opens this Pandora's box of human rights problems and leads to over-moderation of legitimate speech, but to target the surveillance practices, to finally enact a real federal data privacy law, basically cutting off the fuel supply for these data-driven algorithms that are at the root of these platforms' harm.
Right, right. Well, let's get into the bad news first, so we could leave people with, you know, a hopeful, maybe, you know, more active mindset when we end on what can be done. Because, you know, leaving that congressional hearing last week, I sort of thought, like, wow, I think maybe, you know, some of these politicians are finally getting it. You know, Senator Markey of Massachusetts brought up his Kids Act, which I think, you know, it sounds good to me. Take those rules that already exist for broadcast TV and how, you know, for example, a host of a kids show cannot start marketing products within their TV program to children, and move that to deal with, to also work with, you know, to regulate influencers online. That makes sense to me. A lot of these measures in that Kids Act seem to be good in terms of dealing with the harm to young people and teens that the Facebook whistleblower Frances Haugen unveiled. But now, and I actually did not see this until I received that email from Fight for the Future earlier today, and I reached out to you immediately because I was like, oh, I knew this was going to happen. I knew this was going to happen. However, they are also deciding to go after Section 230. And, you know, I've talked about it a lot on this show, but I want to make sure that people who are tuning in for the first time know what's going on here. So can you tell us, what is Section 230? You know, people probably heard it. Donald Trump brought it up a lot last year and how much he hated it. He wanted it repealed. You know, he saw that it was like what was standing in the way of his free speech on the internet, which ironically is quite the opposite. And you can explain.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think the easiest way to think about Section 230 is that it is the law that makes it so the First Amendment works with the internet, right? the difference between, again, a platform like Facebook or YouTube or Wikipedia or Reddit or anything else is the scale, right? We're talking about millions and millions of pieces of user-generated content that get uploaded every day. And, you know, the First Amendment protects all of that content. And actually, the First Amendment protects platforms' right to moderate content as they see fit. That is a form of speech, them deciding, do we want to host this piece of speech or not? But if you have to fend off a lawsuit from every neo-Nazi that gets mad that you kick them off of your platform, you might win every single one of those lawsuits, but if everybody and their sister can sue you, then you're going to go out of business before you even have a chance to make it into court, unless, for example, you're Facebook and you can afford basically infinite lawyers and lawsuits. So Section 230 is often seen as sort of liability protection for companies, but I think that that's actually sort of a misunderstanding of it. Really what it is it's a protection for users. It's what makes it so that platforms are willing to host our content, our speech, our jokes, our YouTube videos, our memes, our snarky remarks about politicians. And without Section 230, platforms basically would be unwilling to host almost any speech that they're worried would get them a lawsuit. So you imagine the internet becoming Disneyland, where the only content that platforms are willing to host is content that's been vetted by the most risk-averse white dude Silicon Valley corporate lawyers in the world who've decided, no, there's no chance that this content is going to catch us a lawsuit. Without Section 230, basically that's the internet. And you can even see this happening, you know, we see what just happened in Australia, where Australia passed a really restrictive law. They don't have something like Section 230. And so then news platforms started shutting down the comments section of their sites because they would become liable for, you know, everyone's weird uncle who comments at the bottom of some news article. The internet can't really function in that manner. And so, you know, it's been said that Section 230 is the 26 words that created the internet. And really, frankly, it is. But more importantly, it's the 26 words that created like the actual good parts of the internet, the things that we like about the internet, the elements of the internet that give ordinary people, rather than just elites or those who have money to back their opinions, a voice. And I can get into more of it there, but I'll pause there. That's my very high level layperson's overview of Section 230. And it gets a lot more complicated than that once you start talking about how this plays out for different types of platforms and what different types of changes to Section 230 might entail.
Right, absolutely. And I do actually really quick want to get into a little bit of that just so people, because I really want people to understand how important Section 230 is. And one of those things, you know, the two things I want to hit on. One of those things is, you know, you could basically say goodbye to the real-time internet. Like even a company like Facebook or YouTube, you know, if you went to put a post up or you went to upload a video, they probably, like you said, they probably would have the ability because they have the money and the person, you know, the amount of employees or contractors really who can look at this stuff and get it up as near real time. But again, this would all be things that they would have to check before allowing you to really post in public first. Like that's what Section 230 really keeps. It allows you to post things right here, right now. And then you don't have to, you know, maybe if you, you know, go against their each platform's own specific content policies, their terms of service, then you get something taken down. But this, without Section 230, nothing would go up without Facebook, Twitter, YouTube looking at it first. And you know what? I don't even know if Twitter could, it, as big as Twitter is, I don't even know if they would have the ability to hang in there with, you know, the Googles and the Facebooks and monitor this stuff in as close to real time as possible.
No, and if you, you know, take it to something like Wikipedia, right, which doesn't even have a centralized moderation model. They have thousands and thousands of volunteer editors that are making edits to every single page there all the time. You know, if someone goes in and makes an edit to Evan Greer's page and says, you know, Evan Greer loves the band Nickelback, and then I want to sue them for defamation and, you know, severe emotional harm because people now believe that I love the band Nickelback. You know, we're not just dealing with kind of like, you know, Wikipedia's overall liability. There's each individual moderator decision. could be open for liability without something like Section 230 that essentially enables a service like that to exist. I think that's important because a lot of times, and we can get into this in a second, lawmakers, especially right now, when they're talking about changes to Section 230 or just internet regulations generally, they're sort of only thinking about Facebook. Or maybe if we're lucky, they're thinking about like Facebook and YouTube. And they're like, all right, how do we stop Facebook from doing this one thing? And then they write a law that tries to do that. And they're not thinking about how does this law play out for Wikipedia, for Bandcamp, for Discord, for, you know, whatever platforms might come along to replace Facebook or lead to a better, more democratized, you know, more progressive internet. And frankly, I think what we run the risk of is basically getting stuck with the centralized surveillance capitalist platforms that we have now, because they're going to be the only ones that could operate in a regulatory environment where Section 230 has been weakened.
Right. And you brought me perfectly to that, you know, that second point I really wanted to drive home is that, you know, even your Wikipedia example, I feel like, you know, I think we should even get smaller than that so people really understand here. Think about your favorite message board you go to, like that niche message board. Maybe you belong to like a forum with like, you know, your local punk scene, or you're on a forum with, you know, your arts and crafts hobby, whatever that message board or forum or really niche community is. Without Section 230, if just one user posts something on one of those message boards or forums or whatever, and someone sues them, that's it. They go out of business. And they might even, thinking about that, they might not even want to get to that point. All those niche little communities you love, that the money is doesn't exist, it really just is for the love of whatever that thing is, they would probably just close down because it wouldn't be worth the risk of them even being up.
Totally. And, you know, to make it even smaller than that, Section 230 also protects users. You know, so if you look at the statute, it's a provider or user of an interactive computer service. So if I retweet something about you, Matt, that's defamatory, you can't sue me because of Section 230, because I didn't say it, I retweeted it. And what's really ironic is that Trump, who called to repeal Section 230, his own lawyers invoked Section 230 in defending him for retweeting disinformation when someone sued him for defamation. So this is an example, you know, again, where, you know, no matter what your kind of position on this is, whether you think platforms moderate too much or whether you think they moderate not enough, messing with Section 230 isn't going to fix that problem in either direction. And that's why we need to start getting smarter about trying to identify what really is the problem that we're trying to solve here and push for policies that will actually solve those problems, rather than allowing politicians do what they've basically been doing, which is just kind of posturing on these issues, fundraising on these issues, but not really doing anything about it.
Right, absolutely. And now I think anyone who has never heard of Section 230 before, who's listening to this, is probably saying, I love Section 230. How great. Which is why now we should talk about that Section 230 is under attack. And tell us about this bill that really is in response to everything that's been happening with Facebook, which almost makes it, you know, even more depressing, because I really thought we were on the right track finally, and then this bill comes about.
Yeah, so, you know, I will say I still am hopeful that we are on the right track. I think this most recent hearing was much more productive than previous hearings. And in some ways, I think lawmakers are focusing on the right thing. So this new bill that was introduced this morning by Representative Pallone and a number of other top Democrats in the House Energy and Commerce Committee basically attempts to create a carve-out in Section 230 for content that's amplified through a personalized algorithm. So that means an algorithm that's kind of personalized to you based on use of your data. Of course, it defines that so broadly that that could include, for example, Yelp showing you a restaurant recommendation based on your location. So some problems with the definition there, but the idea is they're trying to do something that I think should be done, which is they're trying to basically force Facebook to like turn off the algorithm. If that's what this bill accomplished, I would be all for it. But unfortunately, it would totally fail to accomplish that goal. The bill, and gosh, I can't even remember what it's called. It's called like protecting us from malicious algorithms act of 2021 or something like that. But what this bill would actually do is, and unfortunately this is a problem with a lot of Section 230 reform bills, is it actually kind of amounts to a full repeal of Section 230.
Because the title is even funnier. Justice Against Malicious Algorithms Act of 2021. My God.
Ah, yes. The JAMA. JAMA Act.
The JAMA, right.
Let's all just put on our pajamas and go to bed. That's what this bill makes me feel. No, but, you know, again, so they're trying to take aim at the specific type of algorithmic manipulation, which, again, I agree is the root of the problem. But the problem is if you try to create a carve out in Section 230 for that, platforms like Facebook are not going to turn off the algorithm. They're just going to pump the algorithm full of that Disney-fied, engaging but non-controversial content that has been perhaps provided to them by their new corporate partners that they strike relationships with in order to pump your newsfeed full of, you know, recipe videos and music videos from the band Nickelback and, you know, whatever it is that they think will keep you clicking and scrolling but is not going to catch them a lawsuit. And what that means is that all of the rest of the content, all of our content, user-generated content, effectively gets suppressed, pushed to the bottom because they can't amplify it without facing liability. And when you start to understand that everything on a platform like Facebook is either amplified or suppressed, you start to understand that if you create liability for amplification, then what happens is not that platforms stop amplifying, it's just that they stop amplifying like anything that you'd ever care about. And the effect is basically that the speech of marginalized people will be suppressed, the speech of political activists will be suppressed, the platforms will become effectively unusable for activism or even just kind of basic discussion of politics or the world around us. And then the biggest problem in the end is that none of this is going to pass a First Amendment challenge, because whether you like it or not, recommending content is a form of speech. And so the algorithm itself that either amplifies or suppresses content is likely protected by the First Amendment. And so this bill, even if it passed, which it won't, basically wouldn't stand up in court. And it's important to remember, too, that Section 230 is not some magical lever that you can pull to either allow or disallow things. All it would do if you remove it is it enables lawsuits. But if the underlying speech itself is protected by the First Amendment, then your lawsuit's not going to go anywhere. And so, again, that means that Facebook, who can afford the lawyers to go to court with you and fight and eventually win on First Amendment grounds, survives. But that message board that you were talking about, or even a platform, I would argue, the size of Reddit or Yelp or Etsy, likely don't have the resources to fend off that enormous flood of lawsuits. And so then again, we just get left with Facebook, Google, maybe Amazon as the only platform standing, and everything else gets wiped off the map, which is the exact opposite of what these Democrats say they're trying to accomplish.
Right, right. The interesting thing here is it really does sound like that, I mean, and again, not surprising because how much our politicians, who I think the median age in the Senate is like late 60s or something like that, they don't seem to quite understand these things. And from what this bill seems to sound like, it seems like they feel that like algorithms are bad, period. Like algorithms are the problem. Like, yes, algorithms are the problem, but specific algorithms and specific traits or qualities and how these algorithms are quoted or are coded are the problem. It's not like algorithms in general, because like you mentioned, you know, algorithms make the internet better in terms of making sure that you see things that are relevant to your interests, that are things that you would like, it just seems like the internet, it would be a completely different place.
Yeah, I mean, I would push back on that a little bit, because I do think, again, I do think lawmakers are correct to focus in on surveillance-driven algorithms specifically. And, you know, all of this stuff comes with trade-offs, you know, and I think that's another part of the conversation that just gets glossed over. Like, people want there to be some, like, magical silver bullet solution that's going to, like, fix all the bad parts of the internet and save all the good parts. And, like, that's just not the reality. Like, there's always going to be trade-offs with any proposal, right? But I would argue that, you know, I personally would love to see like a moratorium on platforms like Facebook and YouTube engaging in algorithmic manipulation. I would be happy to go back to the days of just kind of like chronological feed if there was a way to kind of elegantly accomplish that. But I would argue that trying to do that through Section 230 is the wrong approach. It basically opens this Pandora's box of human rights issues. And one thing I wanted to specifically say is this will disproportionately impact people who don't speak English and people who live outside the US. One of the biggest revelations from Francis Haugen's testimony was that Facebook and likely other platforms are disproportionately underinvesting in human moderation outside the US. So that means they're relying on artificial intelligence to conduct a lot of that moderation, which means if you slap them with the potential for liability for content, then the people who are whose voices are going to be disproportionately silenced by that are people who live outside the US, people of color, immigrant communities, basically, you know, all the places where Facebook is already underinvesting. So, you know, what I would argue, and we can get, you know, more into this in a second, but rather than tinkering with Section 230 to try to address this problem of personalized algorithms, I think the goal should be to cut off the fuel supply by finally passing a data privacy law. And this is like, this drives me nuts. You know, Congress has been dragging their feet on this for years. Every single politician from both parties, all they do all day is talk about reining in big tech, and we're going to take on big tech, and we're going to crack down on those Facebooks and Googles and Amazons. They have not done a single damn thing on privacy, which is the root of these companies' power. What makes them so powerful is the data that they collect on all of us. And it's a lot easier and cleaner and less messy to just say, no, you can't collect enormous amounts of data on people that you don't need in order to provide them with a service. That would do so much more to prevent the spread of online disinformation, to prevent the kind of rabbit hole white supremacists using the internet to recruit other white supremacists phenomenon than any attempt to regulate speech or any messing with Section 230. And bonus, it wouldn't create a Pandora's box of new problems or suppression of speech of marginalized people in social movements.
Right. Let's get more into that actually now. But before we do that, just one more point I wanted to discuss with you. You know, you mentioned, you know, marginalized groups and people living outside the U.S. as being most affected by a lot of these things. And I think another great point is, yes, while Section 230 is like, obviously, it's a U.S. law, you know, these companies, like you pointed out, their focus is the United States. That's why when they do hire human, moderators, it's mostly for U.S. content because they should look at other content as you know, we'll just have the AI take care of that and have automated systems look at that. But at the same time, like without Section 230 or a much different Section 230, any changes these platforms make would probably just be made across the board because it's easier. So, you know, that would also affect people outside the U.S. Do you agree with that assessment?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this, you know, anything that messes with Section 230 is going to affect everyone. And, you know, I think all you have to do is look at the last major change to Section 230, which was SESTA-FOSTA, which was a bill that was purported to be about preventing sex trafficking. And ask any sex worker, what actually happened is that it led to widespread deplatforming and censorship of consensual adult content online, which included not just porn, but also, you know, people who are doing sex education, people who are doing LGBTQ harm reduction, people who are trying to provide people with health information, getting their content swept off the internet. Because this is, I think, the crux with Section 230. Corporations are really good at avoiding liability. Corporations are happy to bend over backwards to avoid getting sued, even if it means trampling on your rights. And so if you try to just create more liability for platforms hosting speech without doing anything to make sure that they don't then just turn around and screw over the most marginalized members of our community, that's what's going to happen every single time. And so that's why I think it's just a fundamentally flawed approach to try to create liability for speech, because in the end, Controversial speech is not just the speech that we hate. It's the speech of people who have been historically silenced and oppressed. And I think when you look at deplatforming, we often think about, again, the neo-Nazis and jerks and assholes that are complaining all the time because they got kicked off of some platform. But the reality is the people who are systematically deplatformed from big tech the most are Arab and Muslim folks that live outside the US whose speech is caught up in anti-terrorism filters that use artificial intelligence. So it's just important that we actually know who we're talking about and who's actually most impacted by this so that we don't start calling for policies that actually end up harming the very people that we claim we're supposed to be trying to protect.
Right. And a perfect example of that is that finally the list of what Facebook considers to be dangerous organizations and individuals has finally leaked. I mean, this is a list that people have talked about without knowing, who is on this list. Basically, Facebook has been making these decisions about, you know, if you mention this specific organization or individual, your content will be, you know, moderated because we don't want these individuals mentioned on the platform or discussion around them on the platform. And it was always like, but who are they? And they wouldn't tell us. And now this list is leaked. And what we've seen, I think The Intercept, The Intercept got it. And what we see on this list is something like, I don't want to put a percentage because I don't remember exactly what it was, but the vast majority of the groups that Facebook looks at as dangerous organizations or individuals are Middle Eastern-based, Arabic, Muslim groups. And even when you look at the list and see the tier levels where, like, you know, the most dangerous down to like who's just like a hate group and like not quite a terrorist group, though, it's all those organizations. And then you have like legitimate like United States based militia organizations at like the bottom rungs, the Proud Boys at like the bottom rungs. It's like we've seen them in the streets here in this country terrorizing people, yet for Facebook, it's, you know, something that has an Arabic or Muslim sounding name and looks like they just get thrown right at the top of that list of dangerous groups.
No, yeah. And I mean, again, it amazes me that people, and I get it. Look, you know, we all have experienced trauma. It's a scary time. But it amazes me that people are so eager to kind of create a situation where social media platforms remove speech based on, you know, kind of government guidance when we just lived through 4 years of Donald Trump, who considered Black Lives Matter and Antifa to be terrorists, right? You know, it's not hard to think a few years into the future, and God forbid if we have someone like that in office again, how this type of thing could play out when you see that Facebook's internal kind of dangerous organizations list, it more or less mirrors the U.S. government's, right? And as that's something that can shift very quickly. And I think it's just really important that we don't put our trust in these giant corporations to basically be the arbiters of what should and shouldn't be seen. And again, that doesn't mean that no moderation should happen ever. What it means is that we need to start looking at the structural underlying issues of these harms rather than just going back and forth in this endless circle of debate over specific pieces of content, specific organizations, what should be up, what should be down. We need to look at the underlying structures that are at play here, and also, frankly, look at the broader societal structures that are at play. You know, not every problem can be fixed by tweaking Facebook's algorithm. I would argue that you could do a lot more to prevent the spread of extremism in the U.S. by enacting, you know, universal health care than by anything that you could do messing with Facebook, just by starting to meet people's basic needs and address some of these problems and injustices in our society. I think that that's really important because we can sometimes just get a little over-focused on things that are new rather than recognizing that some problems are actually really deep problems that have been baked into our culture and society and economics and politics for decades and aren't going to be something that we can fix by tweaking some policy around technology.
Right. Absolutely. But what we can fix, let's get a little bit more into that. The how basically, so what would, so I guess for people who don't quite understand, how would regulations based on, you know, privacy of our data affect what Facebook does? Because, you know, I don't want to get into something, this is a little bit different, but to me, in my estimation, like you brought up before, like internet where like things were in like platforms back to being chronological order. And actually think like, you know, a lot of platforms, you know, YouTube, Twitter, if they did that, I feel like not much, you know, I feel like the general experience, the good experience people have really wouldn't change too much, I think. But Facebook, on the other hand, it really, the way that platform is built, it really does foster like the ultimate filter bubble. Like it is like in a way that no other platform is. Like on Twitter, you get involved in public conversations and there's always people in your replies who disagree with you. And there's not like, you know, you've not like created like a walled garden of yourself in on there. Same with YouTube in some ways, being that, you know, these videos are all public. Your subscriber, the video, the channels you subscribe to aren't public. So, you know, it's not like anyone could, you know, really the users aren't even public on YouTube unless you're commenting or publishing videos. Like you don't, like no one can find who you're subscribed to. But Facebook, it really is like just this unbelievable like filter bubble where it's just like, if you believe that, you know, COVID is a hoax, and you, because you've been viewing this content, have just friended all these people who are in that same, who have those same beliefs, then like you would think like the whole world is talking about how COVID is a hoax 24/7, because that is all your newsfeed is. There is no outside coming in to tell you otherwise. Your newsfeed is completely based on that. And that to me is just like, I don't know how you fix that at this point, even with like any changes, because like the damage is already done. Like those people will still have those friends on their, you know, on their feed, you know. But what could we do to mitigate that?
Totally. And I think that's the right question, is mitigation, right? Because I think we're fooling ourselves if we pretend that we can, again, solve all of society's problems with some tech policy change, right? And again, you know, filter bubbles are not a new problem. Like I don't know that the world was a better place when people basically could only get their news from Fox News, CNN, New York Times, Washington Post. You know, that wasn't necessarily a better information ecosystem, although, you know, plenty of people maybe would argue that it was. I'm not sure that I agree. But here's the thing, and I think we've done kind of a bad job of explaining this in the past. All what you just described is about how these algorithms are driven by surveillance. So it's not just that they're juicing content that's engaging. They're not just saying, okay, everyone seems to like this video of a drunk squirrel, let's show the drunk squirrel video to more people. Right? That's kind of like old school internet, or maybe like early YouTube, if you will. That's maybe sort of what TikTok is like now, to a certain extent. What Facebook and Instagram are doing is they're saying, hey, you know, you liked this page about vaccine mandates. You know, maybe you want to meet these QAnon people over in this other group. Because what we've recognized from our big data harvesting is that people who like this page railing against vaccine mandates tend to like this other page as well, right? That can't be done without collecting, storing, and analyzing your personal data. And so that's where a federal data privacy law that makes it illegal for them to collect that data in the first place, that is essentially the fuel for the algorithm machine. That's where lawmakers can kind of surgically come in and say, let's just cut off that fuel supply. And then that doesn't magically make the, you know, QAnoners and the vaccine conspiracy theorists go away. They're still going to be there. They can still say their piece. But what happens is Facebook is not then actively helping them find each other and kind of pushing people toward more and more extreme content in pursuit of advertising dollars. So it sort of takes away the incentive for Facebook to basically help the worst people in the world find each other, and brings us back to, you know, more of just like, hey, the internet is a place where like you can kind of find whatever you want if you're looking for it, but you're not having it shoved down your throat, right? And again, that's not necessarily going to end all the harm, but it is a significant harm reduction measure. Right. And I think it's notable, you know, we launched this campaign just the other day, which, you know, obviously I emailed you about, howtostopfacebook.org. We now have nearly 60 organizations signed on, you know, a who's who of almost every notable human rights, civil liberties, civil rights, immigration, LGBTQ, sex worker advocacy, like you name it, organization in the U.S., around the world. who all agree that a strong federal data privacy law would be a significant harm reduction measure. Now, some of those groups believe that we also need antitrust, or some of those groups even believe that we need to change Section 230. There's a lot of disagreement and debate about what else we need to do. But when Facebook or politicians say, well, no one agrees on what we should do, that's BS, because everyone agrees that a data privacy law would at least do some good. And so I think, you know, we shouldn't let politicians get away with being like, well, we just don't know what to do, when there's actually this very clear path forward. And frankly, I'll put this back, on Joe Biden and Democrats. Democrats have for years have been saying we want to do a data privacy law, but Republicans are standing in our way. And right now the Democrats control the House, they control the Senate, and they control the White House. So if they can't get some basic data privacy protections in place, it's going to be pretty hard to take them seriously when they say they want to rein in big tech and prevent their abuses, because that's one of the clearest things that they could do to accomplish that goal. And, we're going to be pushing them to try and make sure that they do.
Absolutely. And it also kills two birds with one stone in terms of making sure also that advertisers don't have access to all this data on you. One last question. I know you got to jump, but one last question. Do you think that this bill, and obviously, this isn't going to be the only bill. I think we're going to see a sustained attack against Section 230. But do you think, Democrats are just misunderstanding the problem? Or do you think they really do want to rid, they have other, reasons for going after Section 230? Because my estimation has always been that Republicans know, or at least some Republicans, like Ted Cruz, when he's railing against Section 230, he knows what he's doing. And I think what that is that, they know that right-wing speech, due to the nature of it, tends to be more moderated on the internet, because it often does go into areas of, white supremacy, anti-LGBT, all sorts of, hateful speech. And so they feel like, if we make this, make this an issue of free speech for our followers, our base, and they think Section 230 is the problem, and we get rid of Section 230, then we've evened the playing field for us, and they have to play by our rules, where all of our content is constantly being moderated and not just the rights.
Yeah, it's funny because, if they ever succeeded in getting Section 230 weakened or repealed, the Ted Cruzes of the world would be the first ones kicked off the internet. It is just sort of this, ridiculousness. In terms of your question, like, why are Democrats doing this? I think there's a range here. This bill this morning, I think, is largely about messaging. They're trying to say, hey, we're mad at Facebook, we're mad at their algorithm, and we want them to stop. That's fine. I'm mad at Facebook too. I'm also mad at their algorithm. I also want them to stop, but I'm not willing to throw marginalized communities under the bus to try to accomplish that goal. I think, there's a range. I do think, frankly, a lot of people would like to see speech that they don't like scrubbed from the internet. And I just think, we need to rethink that a little bit and ask ourselves, try to reconnect with some of those core democratic values. Again, that doesn't just mean anything goes or, no moderation anywhere. But I think we should interrogate our instinct to just try to shut down conversation online and recognize the way that it tends to backfire on truly marginalized members of our community. But in the end, I think a lot of these bills from Democrats specifically are just well-intentioned. They're trying to accomplish the right thing. They're going about it the wrong way. And frankly, it's my job and our job as activists to try to educate them and try to, push them in the right direction. That's why we're mobilizing this big campaign around federal data privacy legislation. And, I try not to lose too much sleep over these types of messaging bills and just keep my eyes on the prize of, protecting these core values of online freedom of expression, human rights, and fighting for an internet that, we can believe in and leave to our children and our children's children.
Absolutely. Ladies and gentlemen, Evan Greer, she is the director of Fight for the Future. Check them out at fightforthefuture.org. Also go to howtostopfacebook.org to really understand the actual ways we should be going about the Facebook problem that is not going after Section 230. Evan, is there anything else you'd like to promote? Any Twitter account, anything you want to feel free right now?
Yeah, sure. You can follow me at Evan_Greer. And yeah, I mean, I think just, you know, get involved in this stuff. These tech policy fights are going to be defining issues of our generation. There's a lot of great organizations out there. And what I would encourage folks to do is look for organizations that are being led by the people who are most impacted by these issues. Organizations like Media Justice, who are focused on the impact of tech policy issues on communities of color. Organizations like the Woodhull Freedom Foundation, that are focused on the impact of these issues on LGBTQ communities. When you start listening to the people that are actually getting screwed over by these platforms, instead of to, you know, big NGOs based out of Washington, D.C., solutions come more into focus.
Thank you so much for joining us. Have a great night.
Thanks so much, Matt. Take care.
Bye. All right, folks, give me a second here to just, there we go. All right, yeah, I that was a great conversation. I've been wanting to do a Section 230 episode. I know I've probably discussed it at length, actually, before, but I wanted to do one specifically on that, and we would be doing more, because it's like I said, this is the fight to come. And also, this is probably now, this is the third episode of Doomed in a row where I've been on this Facebook beat. And I want you, I'm sure a lot of you realize, but I want to really stay on this while the spotlight is on that company, because I think it's important. I mean, you had the leaked documents followed by the Facebook whistleblower testimony, followed by now this Section 230 bill. I mean, and I've been receiving messages, a lot of messages lately, from people over the past 3 weeks who've said to me, you know, there's no one else in this genre of shows focusing so much on the problems with big tech and specifically Facebook. And I appreciate it because, you know, it's different from everything else I'm hearing. And that means a lot to me, because that's what I'm striving to do. Give you guys something different and also focus on issues that other people in your media diet might not be talking about. Because to me, this is big. This is big. Facebook is an all-encompassing organization and an all-encompassing corporation where basically every facet of your life is affected by this company somehow now. Even if you're not on Facebook, really. I mean, you probably, you know, with COVID going on, there might be a friend or family member you no longer even associate with because of their brains have been scrambled by the shit they were recommended to check out on Facebook. So, you know, I hope, you know, I don't know if there'll be a fourth Facebook episode in a row, but we will definitely be staying on this, even if next week I do a show on a different topic. Folks, we're going to go to the second half of the show. You could support this show by going to patreon.com/Matt Binder, patreon.com/Matt Binder. Lost a few patrons this week due to the main issue of money issues. And I want to implore you, and someone even apologized to me. They said they lost their job, so sorry to have to cancel. And I said, I didn't say anything yet because I just saw it. But I want to say to all of you now, if you cannot afford to subscribe to this show via the Patreon, I completely understand and don't. The Patreon is for people who can afford to financially support this show. It's just $5 a month. You can give a little bit less. You can give a little bit more if you want. You give a lot more if you want, but you give a little bit less if you want. What I mean by that is if you have extra money, you have $5 in your pocket, and you're like, yeah, this is not money I need. My bills are all paid. Rent is paid. Family is well fed. We're good. I got $5 I want to spend for entertainment or something I'm into. That's the money I'm asking for. Patreon.com/Matt Binder. Do not feel bad if you cannot afford to become a patron or keep subscribing as a patron. Shit happens. And you need to take care of yourself and your family first. There are other ways to support this show that do not require your money. You can go to the YouTube channel, youtube.com/MattBinder, and subscribe to the channel. That's free. Same with following it on Twitch, twitch.tv/MattBinder. Follow me on Twitter, @MattBinder. Wherever else there are social media platforms, search Matt Binder. You'll probably find me there. Follow me on there. Go to ratethispodcast.com/doomed. And there you can find links to where you can leave podcast reviews for this show. Now, that is a big help. That is the perfect way you can help this show without spending a dime. And if you need some inspiration on the type of reviews you can leave, you can, did I read this one? I don't remember. Maybe I did read this one. I don't know. But if I didn't, this is from Kingston, you know, left a couple weeks ago at Apple Podcasts. I love Doomed. Matt, you are rock solid. Great political analysis with a bit of punk flavor. Check it out, folks. There you go. That's simple. All you got to do is leave a little review like that. How else can you support this show? For the podcast version of the show, go to doomedcast.com and subscribe to the podcast there. There's a number of different outlets. I believe Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify. Subscribe. And here's another great way to help this show without spending a dime. Say you already subscribe via Apple Podcasts. Go to all the other platforms and subscribe too. Pump those numbers up. Let a lot of people, especially on like a platform that shows how many subscribers. I think like Spotify shows how many people follow a podcast. Just go to Spotify and search Doomed with Matt Binder and follow it. Really easy. And I don't even think Spotify will clog your feed, your RSS feed, because Spotify considers itself a separate platform. So definitely follow it on follow Doomed on Spotify. Can't leave Super Chat still. Because I'm still demonetized on YouTube. If you can afford to subscribe again, patreon.com/MattBinder. Losing a couple $100 a month from not being able to do Super Chats. It sucks. What else? Let's go to the second half of the show. You can call in, open up Skype, search Doomed Live, and just call in there. Skype is easy because it's free to download and free to use. Skype calls cost you nothing because it's a Skype user to Skype user. So, even the call is free. You're not even like using up minutes on your cell phone or whatever. There's a web version. There's a mobile version. It's super simple to call into the show. Just download Skype, open it up, search Doomed Live, and there you go. You can call in. Let's go to that second half. Now I got some really interesting clips, including Steven Crowder received a week ban from YouTube, and they took down one of his live streams. I got that live stream, and I looked through it, all 1 hour and 30 minutes of a Steven Crowder show, to find out why he got banned for a week, a hard strike from YouTube. Can't use it at all. Can't upload, can't live stream. He can't do shit on YouTube for a week. This has happened to him before, but he's been extra careful, quote unquote, lately. But it just happened to him again, and I found the segment, and we're gonna take a look and comment and add analysis to it. YouTube, if you're listening, this is not just a regurgitation. We're not promoting it. In fact, I have quite the shellacking to do to Steven Crowder over this, because it is A, the segment's insane. B, the segment is completely wrong. Factually wrong. Not like, it's wrong for you to say that. That's not nice. No, I mean, it's factually wrong. The story he's covering and riffing on is completely bullshit. But anyway, that's going to be the second half of the show. If you're listening on the live stream, you could stick around. If you're a patron, you can stick around and listen to this second half as a replay. For the freebies, this is where I bid you adieu and tell you all that I will see you next time on Doomed.